You're listening to That Life Then, A Blue Morning, Part 1, New York City, 2001, written and read by Jack Merrill. I had a casual thing going with the tough, sexy little Italian actor. He had that rough, tough, leading man look, only shorter. In fact, he'd later shoot a scene on a famous TV show that highlighted his height. One of the leads on the show tried to pick him up until she saw him step off his bar stool, which I think led to a whole thing about height. I don't know. Height seems to be an issue with a lot of women. But height holds no weight with me. This tough, sexy little guy wasn't in the closet, but he wasn't waving any rainbow flags either. You know, you could probably say the same about me. Well, it could be confusing. People have always said to me, you know, you don't act gay. Which, over time, has morphed into the more politically correct, oh, I never would have known, or something along those lines. But however people say it, it's never made any sense. Because, hey, give me the right guy, and I can act really gay. And as far as I know, that is textbook gay. Identity's a funny thing. We're a supposedly individualistic country, yet people want to paste labels on you whenever possible so they can file you away for easy reference. But with me, labels have never come easy. For example, my father was Jewish, my mother was Catholic, and I was raised Unitarian. So what am I? Right? I mean, over the years, lots of Jews I've met are quick to assume I'm a denying, self-hating Jew until they find out my mother was Catholic. Then they usually remind me that I'm not really Jewish, which I never said I was in the first place. The rules say being Jewish is passed only through the mother, which, you know, is pretty smart if you think about it. They want to be absolutely sure about the transference of those Jewish genes. But Hitler didn't care about those rules. He had rules of his own. And to him, I would have been classified a Jew, for sure. I've also found it interesting that if I say I'm not Catholic to a Catholic, they never tell me I'm a denying, self-hating Catholic. Why is that? Why does one side seem fine with me not identifying with the religion of my parent, but the other side sees my lack of co-identification as a betrayal? I've always figured it had something to do with the overall oppression of the Jews, the assumption that I'm hiding who I am to escape identification with the oppressed group. But if the Jews say I'm not Jewish, and in fact, I'm an atheist and have never had any interest in any organized religion, then what exactly is it I'm hiding? An identity that I'm not in the first place? Which brings me back to the gays. When I was growing up, there were no, and I mean no, gay role models I could identify with. The year I got out of high school, a pro football player named Dave Copoy wrote a book about being gay, and that was helpful. I mean, it was a little late, but it was helpful. By that time, I'd already had a boyfriend in high school, and when we were confronted about it at school, we owned up to the reality of our relationship. And let me tell you, navigating those waters back then felt like we were fucking Lewis and Clark out there running the rapids in our little canoe. But Dave Copoy coming out definitely was a good thing for me. See, although I wasn't an athlete, my father worked in professional sports, and most of my friends played sports, so seeing a functioning, successful, masculine, gay athlete felt like a lifeline had been tossed in my direction. So thanks, Dave, wherever you are. Before him, however, there was nothing. I didn't see myself in any of the gay stereotypes that back then were not only considered acceptable, but from what I was experiencing, were expected. If you were gay, you acted a certain way, period. Well, even as a kid, I wasn't about to start adapting my behavior to fit someone else's idea of who they wanted me to be so I could fit into some stereotypical category. Imagine being told to change your voice, your inflections, and the very way you move your body so other people feel comfortable about being able to categorize you. Or to me, even worse, to help you fit in with the very same people who had been given these absurd parameters and accepted them as behavioral norms. The jokey banter that other gay guys I was meeting were gravitating towards was kind of funny, well, for a minute or two. But then what? But that's my identity? Like I said, confusing. Then I went through this whole period where I felt like if I didn't announce I was a gay, that could be interpreted as homophobia or self-hate. For me, it was just like the Jewish thing. If I didn't identify something that is a part of me as the main definitive element of who I am, then I'm self-hating? I mean, when I meet straight people, they didn't come up to me and say, hey, my name's Joe. I'm straight. Although, you know, in certain situations I've learned it is helpful to get that out of the way early on. But if I was seeing someone, where I stood was pretty clear because he was usually standing next to me, and I'm not afraid of public displays of affection. But I started realizing that if I didn't tell someone who was new in my life, like, right away, it could be construed that I was in the closet, and things could get weird. You know, this also made me very cognizant of racial issues. What if I felt categorized before I even had the opportunity to say or do anything? I couldn't even imagine what that would be like. I had an incident where a movie director I was working with didn't know I was gay. A guy I was dating went to college with an actor the director knew, and this actor friend of my boyfriend's told the director I was dating a friend of his. And the director got upset and came back to me all red-faced saying that everyone knew I was gay but him, like I'd been dishonest because I hadn't told him myself. After that, I've made a subtle point of making sure people have some idea of what's going on. My friend Ginny, who I'm going to bring up later, still laughs about the fact that I told her right away. I said, look, you know, just so you know, I'm gay. And she was like, okay, calm down. I think that director thing had just happened and I was done with it. But you know what's tricky? Because like, I don't want That Life Then to be labeled a gay podcast. It's just a podcast that has some gay stuff in it because I'm talking about my life. You know, I want it to be for everyone. People use the phrase identity politics. From my experience, politics is identity. Anyway, this tough little actor guy that I was somewhat seeing had recently discovered that he liked big gay dance clubs, and he wanted me to meet him one Sunday night for some nonsense at some uptown club I'd never even heard of, and somehow he got me to say I'd go. When the night rolled around, I'm sure I tried to wriggle out of it, and he must have used some seriously pervasive powers to get me to leave my house. I was living in the West Village in Manhattan, on a beautiful cobblestone tree-lined stretch of Barrow Street between Hudson and Greenwich. If you don't know the neighborhood, it's a really beautiful part of New York City. My apartment took up the entire ground floor of a townhouse that had been built in the 1820s on the same block and at the same time as St. Luke in the Fields Church on what was, back in the 1820s, farmland, hence the name of the church, St. Luke in the Fields. Although the fields had been gone for over a century and a half, living in that house was the closest I ever came to living in the country in the middle of Manhattan. My apartment had walls that were so thick, if you were in the front room overlooking Barrow Street and you yelled really loud, you might be heard in the bedroom, which was in the back overlooking a garden. I rented from St. Luke's, as they owned all the townhouses that ringed the double-sized block. The center of the block was filled with a beautiful English-style garden, and all summer long, I could gaze from my bed or my desk onto a view filled with flowers and bees and dragonflies. Not your typical Manhattan vista. Barrow Street runs at odd angles, which makes it one of those streets that people don't usually head down, and it's remarkably quiet given its proximity to the late-night buzz of the West Village. On a Sunday night after 10, Barrow Street was as close to silent as anywhere can be in Manhattan, which is exactly the hour when I'd been coerced to leave the quaint confines of my cozy little home. I walked a few houses over to stand on the corner of Hudson, not wanting to walk up to Christopher Street, trusting that sooner or later a cab would be headed back uptown after dropping someone off in Soho or Tribeca. Do you have a match? A cute kind of goofy guy had stopped and turned around after walking past me. No, I don't, I said. He took another step and then stopped and turned around again. Are you flirting with me? He said with a confused look on his face. His opener was so clumsy, I think I choked. No, I said. Actually, you're flirting with me. And doing a really terrible job of it, I thought. But he was so cute and so bumbling. Totally charming. Big blue eyes and a cleft chin. He looked like the well-scrubbed Mormon he'd proved to be. Or should I say, ex-Mormon. You're not allowed to be a Mormon and stop guys on deserted street corners and ask them if they're flirting with you. You get kicked out for that. I said, hold on a second. And ran over to my house and got a match and a pen, lit his cigarette and wrote down his number. I'll call you, I told him, as I hailed a lone cab headed uptown. The club was empty and abysmal, as I figured it would be, and I kept thinking how cute that guy was. I was glad I got his number. The next morning, I headed out for my coffee and muffin at my usual spot, a little place called Out of the Kitchen around the corner on Hudson, when I ran right into the cute guy from the night before. "Hey, you're that guy from last night. I was going to call you later," I said. He looked even better in the daylight. Still kind of gawky and awkward, but actually, movie star handsome, with an easy smile. "Well, I work right here across the street at a small production company." "Oh, well, I'll call you later and we'll make a plan." I smiled as we parted. I rode a mountain bike every day in Manhattan, even to drop off and pick up my laundry. And later that afternoon, I was headed back from the wash and fold with my oversized brown canvas mail bag stuffed with clean folded laundry propped up across my handlebars when I ran into him again. "Come on. What, 3 times in less than 24 hours? What, are you stalking me?" I asked. "Maybe." He laughed. He told me he rode a bike too, sealing the deal. Well, are you busy tonight?" "Nope." He smiled. "Well, let's go for a ride and see a movie or something." "Okay," he said, smiling that wonderful smile of his. That night, we rode our bikes down the bike path to Battery Park City and saw Jurassic Park 3 at the Multiplex, stopping on the way there and back to make out at the guardrail overlooking the Hudson River. He's a great kisser, and I'm a big believer in that song. It's in his kiss. His name was Danny, and he was recently out of a relationship and living in Brooklyn while working at some production company run out of an apartment not even a block from me. As I was living alone, and we hit it off so easy, there was just no need for him to ride the subway all the way back to Brooklyn, and in no time at all he had his own key and was staying over every night. Danny was an unusual character. Like I said, my apartment had extremely thick, solid brick and plaster walls. One night, we were laying in my old mahogany sleigh bed that I still own, having dragged it around for decades now. Anyway, we were laying in my bedroom in the back, which I always thought had a sound that was almost sepulchral. It was so quiet. "You have mice," Danny said. No, I don't." "Yes, you do. In fact, there's one right now in the living room. He's eating something. It sounds like a carrot." "Okay, that's insane." I smiled. I mean, I love that he was such a kook, and I love that he thought there was a mouse in my living room eating a carrot. "Well, give me that flashlight and follow me," he said. Putting a finger up to his lips, he motioned me to follow him through the long hallway that led up to the living room up front. He scanned the dark room with a light beam until he found what he was looking for. "There," he said. "Look." And sure enough, there he was, sitting in the corner of my ash-filled fireplace below the grate up against the burnt brick side wall, a little gray mouse perched up on his hind legs eating a carrot. "I can't believe you didn't hear him," Danny said. "He was keeping me awake." On another night, he said, "Do you hear that rumbling?" "No, there's no rumbling." "Yes, there is," a while later. "There, you hear that?" "What?" That rumbling, it sounds like a subway." "Okay, yeah, I don't hear any rumbling, and the subway's all the way over on 7th Avenue, and I don't care if you can hear a mouse in the fireplace eating a carrot. You can't hear the 7th Avenue subway a mile away." There it is again. Oh, God. But of course, he was right. On the other side of the double block that St. Luke's owned, under Christopher Street, there was a station for the PATH train from New Jersey. There was a rumble. I just couldn't hear it. I'm not sure any human could, other than him. I learned to trust Danny's ability to hear and see things beyond my capabilities. After the 6th week, we both realized that maybe we should take a breather, as we hadn't spent hardly a moment of free time apart since we'd met. He decided to go back and stay in Brooklyn for the coming week, and I said maybe you should start thinking about forgetting about that Brooklyn apartment altogether and moving in with me. In my experience, if it's going to work, you just got to take the plunge. That Monday, after Danny got off work, he stopped over to say he was headed back to Brooklyn to start our week apart. There was a big storm blowing outside, and he was already soaked to the bone, and it was still raining really hard. "Yeah, let's just start the week tomorrow night," I said. "It's shitty out there. Come on, stay here tonight." And so he did. My usual Manhattan clock was asleep by 2, up by 10. Danny's production job had him out of the house by 9:30 at the latest. We were both asleep when the phone rang a little before 9. It was Ginny. Ginny was that girl I was talking about earlier. A super smart, vivacious blonde beauty full of fun. But now she was yelling something about a plane in the World Trade Center. What? I said. Danny sat up looking at me. Slow down, slow down. What happened? I held up the phone so Danny could hear. I heard this plane fly low over my apartment and it crashed right into the World Trade Center, she said. I was up out of bed putting on my clothes. Are you home alone? Yeah, Michael's downtown. I just talked to him. Okay, we're coming to you. I knew Ginny was pregnant and in the middle of moving. The tech crash had recently gutted her husband's startup, which had been worth literally hundreds of millions of dollars one minute, but the next had meteorically slammed back down to earth. She was meeting movers that morning to clear out their dot-com penthouse, which on that brilliantly clear morning afforded her an unencumbered view of the planes as they flew towards their target. We have to go up there, I said to Danny. She wasn't far, just above 14th Street, less than a mile uptown. As Danny jumped into his clothes, I ran out into the blindingly bright morning, stumbling over the wide cobblestones as I headed to my right towards the corner of Barrow and Greenwich, where groups of people were standing at the corner looking up in downtown, which was to my left. Greenwich Street dead-ended right into the World Trade Center, about a mile below my house. Looking down Greenwich, everyone standing there had a direct, clear shot to where the building stood burning. There was a person I often saw walking up and down Barrow Street, who possessed the build of a pro football player he may once have been, but now had given over to prim, smart English tweed suits and matching skirt and sweater sets, and whom I had, on more than one occasion, said hello to, you know, as neighbors do. This person, however, had always ignored my hellos. On this morning, apparently things had changed, and here they were, in a light pink getup, complete with a hat and silk neck scarf, sensible shoes, the whole thing, all revved up and ready to chat. What happened? This person said to me in a high-pitched put-on falsetto. What happened? They said again. I stood speechless, looking up at the two buildings as they loomed in the distance, billowing smoke out of holes that looked to be multiple stories high. This person then screeched at me again, this time right up in my ear, as if perhaps I needed a hearing aid. What happened? I don't know, I said. A crash. Some kind of crash. I moved away, down the center of Greenwich Street, looking up at the towers. It was as if everything stopped. Everything. All the sounds, the people, time itself, like warped speed, only slower. I stood there staring, trying to get my mind around it. Two planes? This is deliberate, I thought. I could hear people behind me, voices off in the distance, and I could hear them yelling into their cell phones, but I just kept staring up, looking at the smoke and the red flames billowing out of the two buildings. Right there, right in front of me. It was almost incomprehensible. It looked like something was coming off, like the buildings were coming apart, like there was sand pouring over the side, like in an hourglass. Something kept coming loose, falling down the sides, just faint, but steady. What was that? And then I realized it was people. People were jumping. I snapped out of it, running back to the middle of the short block where Danny was waiting out front with our bikes. As soon as we took off towards Ginny's, one of his tires went flat. Go, he said, I'll be here. Come back as soon as you can. As I kissed him, he pressed a disposable camera into my hand. There was hardly any traffic. As I rode my mountain bike uptown, everyone I passed had stopped and were looking up and behind me. Cabs and trucks had pulled over and gotten out of their vehicles, standing with their doors and their mouths wide open, staring up into the sky. A few cabs had turned their radios up loud and groups of people stood around leaning on the yellow metal as they looked up into the distance, listening to whatever it was being broadcast, everyone trying to understand what was happening. Ginny's apartment took up the entire top two floors of an 11-story building and had wide single-pane windows looking out over the city. The doorman waved me through, and when I got off the elevator, the hall door was open, all taped up with blue tape over brown paper, protecting the floors and the door frames. The large space was in a ramshackle state of stacked cardboard boxes and moving pads wrapped around all the furniture. There were a couple of moving guys in blue coveralls off to the far right looking out the windows. "Ginny?" I yelled. "I'm in here!" I stood at the doorway of what had been their home office but was now packed up and mostly empty. Ginny, 7 months pregnant, was standing stock still, her back to me in front of a large, unadorned square window, her phone pressed between her shoulder and her ear, as off beyond her in the distance, the buildings burned against the blue. I took the camera Danny had pressed into my hand and snapped a picture that would be printed around the world. "That was my mother," she said, hanging up the phone. "These movers are all Israeli, and they said this is an act of terrorism." We stood staring at each other. A childhood friend of Ginny's named Jeff, who lived a couple blocks away and would go on to great success with his chic restaurants and hotels in New York and Los Angeles, came in a panic with his dog. "Let's go upstairs," he said. On an open terrace a floor above, the three of us stood outside watching as the World Trade Center burned. I took a couple more pictures and called my mother in Chicago on my flip phone to tell her I was all right. I can't remember exactly what was said, but I do remember if I wanted any comfort, she was not the person I should have called. We could see over the buildings across the street, and in one of them a guy opened his window and yelled up at us, "Are you able to see this?" The three of us just stood there staring. What was there to say? I looked down towards him and nodded, silently. I began to wonder how long the buildings would burn. I mean, clearly there was no way to put out the flames. A helicopter was now flying around the top of them, and for me, that little whirly bird only showed the scale of the disaster and how impossible it would be to douse the flames, from the outside anyway. Well, would the flames burn all the way up to the top and then burn themselves out, leaving a scorched frame skeleton at the top of each building? I could see that there were floors burning with an almost white-hot brightness, and I wondered if the fire would weaken the floors at the burning part and cause the top to buckle over and break off like a tree being cut off at the top and falling to the ground. Scenarios swam through my head. I never could have imagined what actually happened. It was fast, and from where we stood, it was silent. The first tower almost shimmered from what looked like glass popping out as the building fell. The only sound I remember was the guy in the apartment across the street yelling up at us about what he'd just seen on TV. "Did you see that? Can you see that?" It felt like something froze inside of me. Defensive walls were clicking into place throughout my entire body. Ginny stared at me with a silent, steely stare. Jeff started crying. Then the south tower fell. I tried to call Danny to tell him what I'd just seen, but my cell phone no longer worked. None of ours did. The main antenna had gone down with the north tower, and all of our cell service went with it. People were starting to arrive. Ginny's stepbrother Todd, a hulking ex-footballer who was now working on Wall Street, came in visibly shaken. He said that all of Wall Street was walking uptown. "I'm okay," Ginny said. "We'll talk later." I hugged her and headed back down to the street where I jumped on my bike, pointing it downtown. Thousands of people were now headed up Hudson, a huge cloud of smoke chugging up into the sky behind them. The wind was blowing away from the city, as it would mercifully do for several days, blowing the toxic smoke out over the Hudson towards the Statue of Liberty and beyond. The first people I rode past looked frazzled, like they grabbed whatever they could. And then there were hundreds, and I mean hundreds behind them, who were covered in light gray ash. They looked like an ancient shell-shocked army made out of clay. They trudged past me while I threaded my bicycle through them. They were, for the most part, almost expressionless, just marching onward, encased in what remained of the World Trade Center, their clothes, their skin, their hair, shoes, purses, briefcases, everything, all dusted a monochromatic gray. Danny was waiting for me. We sat at the bottom of our stoop, and from that moment on, it was no longer my apartment. It was ours. And we watched as a couple who had just paid a fortune for the townhouse across the street and had moved in not a week before, now loaded much of what had just been unloaded, including infant twins, into a fleet of awaiting SUVs and took off, never to be seen on the block again. "We have to go see Jennifer," I said. Jennifer Estes lived on the other side of the West Village on the corner of 7th Avenue and 12th Street, right on the corner. The windows of her second-floor apartment looked straight down 7th Avenue, as St. Vincent's Hospital, which was directly across 12th Street, had been set back a little, making room for an emergency ambulance bay. Starting on the following block, 7th Avenue had been cut through the village in 1914, long after all the other streets had been laid out, creating odd angled star-shaped corners like this one, where Greenwich Avenue angled as it crossed 7th Avenue and 11th Street, creating a large open-air space with a clear view downtown. The March of the Clay People had mostly dissipated, and the streets were pretty empty as we locked our bikes to the subway exit stairs outside of her apartment. Jennifer and I had met at NYU and had gone on to run the Naked Angels Theater Company together. She was now battling Lou Gehrig's disease and had created the nonprofit Project ALS, which would go on to raise tens of millions of dollars for ALS research, and at this point was being run out of her apartment, which had become a central meeting ground. I knew other people would be headed for Jennifer's as well. A few had already arrived and were gathered at the windows, watching as the staff from St. Vincent's set up gurneys to receive patients at the emergency entrance across 12th Street. It was a beautiful day, and the staff was going about setting out rows of gurneys as well as office chairs. Anything with wheels had been set outside and covered with sheets as teams of doctors and nurses stood waiting. A crowd of people, regular New Yorkers, had begun congregating on the corner, hoping to be able to donate blood if any was needed. So many people had begun showing up that someone with a megaphone had come out of the hospital and started directing them to stand out of the way, across 7th Avenue if possible, as they had enough donations for now. Seeing all those people turn up in the middle of all this, to help in any way they could, was the first time I let down my guard enough to feel some emotion. I pushed it back down and went in to see Jennifer. She was sitting up in her bed, as always, breathing with the help of a face mask called a BiPAP. She'd close her mouth and the BiPAP machine would push air into her lungs. She may have had trouble breathing, but she could still talk. Her body, as she used to say, disarming anyone who'd come to visit her, had basically become an artichoke or a zucchini, depending on the day. But she could still talk a great game. And she was funny. So funny. All the way through, she never lost her comedy. Everyone came to that apartment to see Jennifer. From Warren Beatty to Oprah. Katie Couric came by to do a segment and basically never left. Jennifer collected people. She was such a force of nature and was moving mountains in search of a cure. Nobody ever wanted to leave her side. We all wanted her to win, to be the one who beat it. Not a day went by that I didn't stop to see her. Usually on either side of midnight, as she didn't sleep much anyway, and nobody else was there at that hour, other than Lorna or Karen, her remarkable nurses. Jennifer's sister once tried to chew me out for keeping Jennifer up late with my visits. I listened as she yammered on and on. Nothing was going to keep me away. Many of Jennifer's core friends were now in the apartment, eating something or other. A visit to Jennifer's always involves some kind of food. Everyone was standing, watching, at the windows, looking out over the doctors and nurses and orderlies all lined up outside, and what had now become a sizable crowd of people waiting to give blood, then up beyond to a completely deserted 7th Avenue, leading down to an enormous cloud of gray smoke belching up into the bright blue sky. All of us were waiting. Waiting for the ambulances to come up from downtown bringing the survivors. Finally, a lone ambulance pulled up and a woman was helped out of the back. I could see she'd done something to her ankle, and they wheeled her into the hospital. That's when it hit me. Of course. They were all dead. There'd be no triage. No need for all those gurneys and deck chairs covered with sheets. No need for the doctors and the nurses and the orderlies and the crowd of people there to donate blood. Because if you didn't outrun it, like that woman must have done, hurting her ankle in the process, you were dead. Period. Everyone kind of figured it out at the same time. We all just suddenly knew. Of course. 2 110-story buildings had just collapsed into an enormous burning pile. There'd be no survivors being brought uptown. Not now, and not ever. The staff at St. Vincent slowly began to wheel the equipment back inside, rolling back in the desk chairs, and the blood donors were told that if they were needed, a call would go out, but for now it'd be better if everybody went home. I knew I'd be back to see Jennifer later and kissed her cheek before Danny and I headed off back towards Barrow Street. There was a Gristiti supermarket on the far side of the corner of Barrow and Greenwich, a corner I'd stood on that very morning, although it already felt like a lifetime ago. and Danny thought we should go over and buy some food in case the entire city went into some form of lockdown. People were saying that tap water was turning brown, which wasn't true, but we figured we should go stock up on a couple of things at least. The scene inside Gristiti's was right out of any run-of-the-mill horror movie. Anxious pandemonium ruled as people ran around the store stripping the shelves of anything and everything. As I stood in line holding some pasta and a couple jars of peanut butter and jelly, some guy passed me with a cart stacked sky-high with water and who knows what else, and I thought to myself, either he's a jerk or I'm an idiot. When we came outside with our one bag of groceries, I stopped and looked down to my right, taking in the view down Greenwich Street, once a perfect shot of the gleaming towers, but now nothing but smoke and sky where they'd once stood. I'd always loved them. Like an enormous, bright, white tuning fork, anchoring the end of the island. Years before, I'd left the NYU gym one night with a buddy, and we headed across Houston Street to grab some dinner in Soho. The night was foggy and the towers rose up in the distance, glowing through the fog like two magical columns of light. "Look at them," I said. "At any other time in human history, they would have been something out of a dream. These two glowing edifices of light, these magical towers lighting up the night sky." "Oh," said my buddy. "Yeah, I was just looking at them thinking how polluted the air looked tonight." Danny and I made peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and sat eating them on the stoop, watching as people wandered by in a daze. There were other people on our block packing up and leaving town, but we were staying. I wondered where else we would go, even if we had the option. "Hey, have you guys gone down by the river?" somebody asked. "You have to go down there and see what's going on." "Okay. I'm gonna go take a look," I said to Danny. The river was only two blocks away, and when I rode up, I could see people lining the West Side Highway, waving and yelling. As I got closer, it looked like some kind of parade. The most amazing parade I've ever seen. There were fire trucks and emergency vehicles and cop cars with the names of all these different cities on their sides. Stamford, Connecticut, and Passaic, New Jersey. Allentown and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I mean, just from everywhere. These first responders were driving in from all over, all the way to Manhattan, and they were headed downtown to help out. There was a super tough guy I'd seen around at the gym or somewhere, like a handsome Hell's Angels or something, all tatted up before that was a thing. He wasn't a poser, though. He was for real. He was standing there deep in the crowd, and he turned and looked at me. It was all so overwhelming. We didn't really know each other. It was just a familiar face in the crowd. But our eyes locked, and I don't know what happened, but we both burst out crying. Like, pouring out. Both of us. I couldn't stop. There was something about seeing someone I knew, even just a little. Like, suddenly it didn't matter. You know, we were all connected. We needed help, and all these people were showing up. I could tell he was a little embarrassed. I was embarrassed, but what could you do? It was like a dam burst. Here were these throngs of people with goodness in their hearts, and they were coming to help us out. It was incredible. Everyone was waving and crying and honking. I've never experienced anything like it.